When we put a kaleidoscope to our eyes, we see a pleasing pattern of color and of hue. Turn this kaleidoscope this way and that, and we are presented with an ever-changing yet always pleasing aspect of new shapes and new designs. 2,000 years ago, a noted teacher advised his pupils to treat the Bible as if it were a kaleidoscope. Turn it over, he advised them, and turn it over again, for you will find everything in it. The literature of interpretation, of exegesis, of elucidation, and of elaboration, by which the pupils of this teacher and their pupils and every generation of Jewish Bible readers have applied themselves to our Holy Scripture, is called the Midrash. Literally, Midrash means a searching out. It is the searching out with the critical acumen of intelligent readers of the depths of biblical meaning. It is a searching out by readers with a creative imagination of the possible implications of biblical allegory and symbolism. In short, the Midrash is a literature of interpretation, a literature which opens up for the intelligent scholar and teacher new depths, new shafts leading to deep-lying ore of biblical meaning. Let me illustrate. In the book of Exodus, we are told of the delivery of the Jews under Moses from the slavery in Egypt. You'll recall that after they fled from Egypt, they were enabled by a miracle to cross the Red Sea. And once across and having sung their great hymn of deliverance, Moses proposed to lead the people directly to Mount Sinai, where a new law and a new covenant were to be given to them, where they were to be bound together, not as an escaped rabble, but as a people dedicated to God and to faith. He led the people out on this short journey from the shores of the Red Sea to the foot of the Mount of Sinai. But the Bible tells us that at an oasis named Rephidim, the passage of the Jews was opposed by a desert Bedouin tribe, the Amalekites. And in a short, quasi-historical, quasi-legendary, overly miraculous paragraph, the Bible describes the battle that ensued between the Amalekites who opposed the further passage of the Jews into their territory and the Jews who were determined to reach the foot of Sinai. According to the Bible, Moses commanded Joshua to enlist and select the warriors of Israel from the people who had been brought out of slavery. He himself, on the morrow, the day of battle, would go up to a neighboring hill. And there, with the rod of God in his hand, a rod which apparently had some miraculous power, he would await the ensuance of the battle. He would raise his hands to God, the rod of God in his hands. And Moses said to Joshua, as long as my hands are upraised, Israel will prevail. But when my hands grow slack, when they fall to my side, then Amalek will prevail. And the morrow, according to our Bible, Moses did go up unto this hill. He did raise his hands to God, and as long as his hands were upraised, Israel did prevail. But as we might expect, as his hands grew weary, his muscles began to ache and to quiver and to grow tense, and his hands began to slacken to his side, and Amalek began to prevail. And it required the determined help and effort of Aaron, his brother, and of Hur, one of the young captains of Israel's hosts, each on one side of Moses, to sustain his hands aloft until the hour of victory. Reading this miraculous account of a desert battle between Bedouin tribes now lost completely in the dimness of history. The scholars and teachers of our people were unwilling to simply pass it off as a bit of legendary history and let it go at that. They saw in this episode allegories to the fate of Israel, to the fate of every individual. They saw in this episode morals, values for their own individual lives. One rabbi observed in this fashion, can we not say, he mentioned that Moses upraising his hands to God as a sign that Israel will prevail is symbolic of the people of Israel. When Israel's hands are figuratively uplifted, when they are persevering in their faith, when they are determined to abide the responsibilities of establishing justice and righteousness among the peoples, then Israel will prevail against her enemies. But when the hands of Israel grow slack, when Israel ceases to pay attention to its responsibilities, then Israel's enemies will prevail over her. Not by might nor by power, but by my spirit. Such will be the success and the survival of Israel. And another scholar observed that this allegory could equally well be applied to the life of every individual. As long as the individual perseveres in his determination to achieve his life goals, as long as he is determined to abide programs of helpfulness and gentleness and good neighborliness and kindness, so long will he be able to achieve against the worst of the slings and arrows of evil fortune. But when he grows indolent and lazy and weary, when his hands fall to his sides, then life quickly passes that individual by and overwhelms him. And a third rabbi seized upon one of the details of this legendary battle. He observed that it was Moses' determination to sustain his own hands aloft throughout the day into the hour of victory. But his strength, despite his determination, was insufficient for the program which Moses had undertaken. He simply could not hold his hands aloft through the long hours of battle. He needed the support of Aaron and of Hur. Without their support, his hands would inevitably have collapsed to his side, and Amalek would have prevailed. And is there not here, this rabbi observed, a lesson for all who would be leaders of men and champion of good causes? Alone you will be overwhelmed. Alone, your strength will be unequal to the task you have set for yourself. But supported with good, loyal, trustworthy companions, then you can prevail, and only then. And so is it not the part of wisdom for he who would fight the good fight and enlist himself as a leader of the noble cause? Is it not the part of wisdom then for such a man to see to it that he comports himself so as to win the admiration and the loyalty, the friendship and the respect of men who will stand beside him in the hour of battle and sustain him and enable him to come to the desired victory? This is Midrash. It is an interpretation of the biblical text so as to draw from that text every drop of water of meaning which lies in its fountains and in its depths. The Midrash offers us then a key to a full and interesting understanding of the Bible, and also, of course, a key to the understanding of the Bible and of Judaism, which later generations of Jewish teachers sustained and maintained. The 18th chapter, rather, of the book of Leviticus deals with a series of regulations and prohibitions governing and prohibiting incestuous marriage. These regulations are interesting in themselves, for they are basic to the development of the Jewish concepts of sexual purity and of family loyalty. They're also important as indications of how far Israel had already, in these most ancient of days, abstracted itself from the loose sexual moralities of the surrounding nations. But reading this text, one of our great rabbis was able to interpret from it and draw from it perhaps one of the gentlest and certainly one of the grandest of truths that Judaism teaches. Our ancestors read the Bible as the revealed word of God. They felt that there was not a word in the Bible, not a letter in the Bible, not a comma in its pages, which was misplaced or simply there by happenstance. Everything had its meaning and had its purpose. And so when in the peroration, the exhortation with which this chapter of sexual rules begins, Rabbi Meir, a great Tanna of the second century, read this line, "If ye abide my statutes and my ordinances, which if a man do, then he shall live by them." He was struck not as we might be, simply by a conclusion to an encouragement to abide and to accept this law, but that in this sentence he found deep-seated a basic life truth, a basic truth of our faith. What was this truth? This was his observation, and this was his method of interpretation. The Bible, he said, is a Jewish scripture. The biblical law is Jewish law. The Bible was intended for Jewish readers. You might therefore expect, he told his audience, that such a peroration, such a formula of exhortation to abide this law would read in this way, "Ye shall abide my statutes and my ordinances, which if an Israelite do them, he shall live by them." But note, he said, God chose not the specific term Israelite, but the general term man, which if a man do, he shall live by them. God intended in this way to remind us that whether he be Jew or Gentile, if he abide by the basic codes of moral responsibility, he will be rewarded of God. The promise of God's reward, the promise of salvation, is not limited to those who espouse a particular religious profession. And Jews should never be so parochial in their outlook as to judge men by their religious doctrines rather than by the universal standards and measures of human conduct. Nor was this simply a piece of idle observation on the part of a great rabbi in Israel. Rabbi Meir lived in the second century of the Common Era. And during this century, there was not only the continued popularity of the mystery cults, but the nascent popularity of Christianity. And both early Christianity and these very popular mystery cults of the Roman world emphasized that salvation, the reward of God or of their gods, was limited only to those who espoused a particular creed or voiced acceptance to a particular dogma. What Rabbi Meir was saying through this midrash is that Jews should never allow the narrow provincialism of other religions to lead them to forget God is the Father of all men, and that he judges all men with a single standard. Where are these midrashim, these interpretive evaluations of the biblical text, to be found? They are found scattered throughout most of post-biblical literature. Some are found as early as the biblical text of the Dead Sea Covenanteers. Some are found scattered in the early pages of the Apocrypha. Great collections of Midrashim were compiled between the 4th and the 12th centuries of the Common Era. And the greatest and most voluminous of these collections is known as the Midrash Rabbah, the Great Midrash. Other collections of Midrash apply to a particular book whose verses, line by line, are annotated with interpretation. Some Midrashim are to be found in the Talmud. Others are to be found in the Zohar, that great book of mystical Jewish speculation written in Spain in the 13th century. Almost wherever you turn in Jewish belles, in Jewish writing, in the period after the completion of the Bible, you will find the attention of our leaders and of our teachers turn to the writing and the interpretation through Midrash of the Bible. Often these interpretations are far-fetched. For the purpose of the Midrash was not only to understand what was the original intent of the biblical author, but to use the biblical text as a means of placing before the people ideas which this particular writer or that particular writer felt were basic to the Jewish interpretation of life. In the book of Exodus, before God gives the commandments to Moses at Mount Sinai, there's a description of a great outburst of natural phenomena. Thunder peals forth. Lightning shocks down from the heavens. Rain clouds lower overhead. The earth shakes and quivers. The Mount Sinai itself erupts as might a volcano. All of nature seems to be conspiring to point to the onlooker to the climactic importance of the giving of the commandments which is about to take place. And as a conclusion to this natural orchestral accompaniment to the giving of the Ten Commandments, the Bible observes, all Mount Sinai was covered in smoke, and God descended upon Mount Sinai in fire. Now, reading this caused one of the theologians of Israel some 20 centuries ago to pause. He was first of all troubled by the theological implications of this statement. It seemed literally taken to be crude and somewhat anthropomorphic, God descending upon a mountain surrounded by an aura of fire. The biblical author had certainly outgrown any belief of God in human form and with human limitations. And having made this a theological observation, he was led to another. He lived in an age in which programs of rigorous ascetic piety were common and were generally popular. Men sought to prove their faith by mortifying the flesh, by accepting programs of austerity, of prolonged fasting, of enforced celibacy, of self-flagellation. Being a Jew, he stood in a tradition which was opposed to this mortification of the flesh. God did not give religion to man that he might through religion find a reason to deny life, but that religion and religious law might help him to lead the fullest and noblest life for himself and for his society. And having made this theological observation about a difficult text in our Bible, he found reason to preach a sermon which emphasized this Jewish observation on religious piety. He said, if God did not descend upon Mount Sinai in fire, what then descended? Was it not the Torah, the law, the doctrine of religious life which Moses was about to receive from God? And what does the Bible sentence then say about this Torah? Does it not say that it is in many ways to be likened to fire? Well, how is the Torah like to fire? What meaning has this symbolism for man? And then he observed, if a man stands beside a campfire, if he backs away too far from the fire, its flame will not warm him. But if he approaches too close to the flame, he will be singed and burnt by it. And similarly it is with religious practice. If a man backs away too far from religious thought and a religious life, it has no meaning for him. It is superficial to him. He can never receive the comfort or the exaltation which faith promises. But if a man draws too close to faith, if he becomes overly concerned and somewhat unbalanced in his practice, faith destroys him, it burns him up. And in this way, he was able to drive home to his audience an important doctrine in Jewish life, that religious practice requires moderation, reason, as much as any other virtue in life. everything done in excess is wrong. And that is true even of aesthetic religious practices. The Bible then is interpreted critically, it is interpreted imaginatively in the Midrash. And having allowed their imagination free rein in the interpretation of biblical texts, these scholars and teachers went one step further. They began to embroider the story of the Bible itself with a series of legends which added, they thought, beauty and dimension to its text. They began to complete stories which the Bible left incomplete. They began to build up the glory of the biblical heroes and to underscore the perfidy of the biblical villains. They began to explain points which the Bible left unexplained. Let me offer you an illustration. Moses is chosen by God to lead the people out of Egypt. So much is said in our Bible. But a rabbi asked, why? Why was Moses chosen as the vehicle of God's deliverance? What had he done to merit the mantle of immortality? Well, the Midrash offers us a legend explanation. It tells us that when Moses fled Egypt after he had killed the Egyptian taskmaster, he joined the tribe of the Midianites in the Sinai Desert. And there he married the daughter of one of the Midianite chieftains, a certain man named Jethro. And he occupied himself during these years of exile as shepherd to the flocks of Jethro. And God was at this time searching for a man to lead his people out of Egypt. And he passed over Moses tending the flocks of Jethro, and he noted the manner in which he guarded and was jealous of the safety of these flocks. He noticed, for instance, that when Moses drove the flocks out into the pasture, he sent the young sheep up ahead that they might be able first to crop the fresh grass, the most fertile of the pasture. And only after the youngest of the sheep had eaten to their full did he allow the stronger, sturdier of the sheep to enter the pasture, for he was confident that these would be able to graze on the grass which was less easy of access and hardier. And he also noticed that when a young kid wandered away from the flock, Moses would follow that young kid, that stray. And when he would notice that the stray would pause at a rivulet to drink, he would observe his thirst and his hunger and his weariness. Instead of driving the kid back to the flock as might any other shepherd, Moses picked up the kid and placed it across his shoulders and carried it back tenderly to the flock. And God was led to observe that a man who would watch over animals with such gentleness and such compassion and such care, certainly he would exhibit these virtues in heightened degree when he was given the care of the flock of Israel. And it was for these virtues as a shepherd that Moses was chosen for the mission of leading Israel out of Egypt. And how often we ourselves notice in life that the manner in which a man comports himself with his family, towards his children, with his subordinates, is a better indication of his essential character than is the smile which he bears in public or the act of generosity which he places before common view. Sometimes the stories which the rabbis tell as embroidered legend to the Bible seem far-fetched. Sometimes their spirit seems alien to the spirit of the Bible, and it was undoubtedly at times so. But more often than not, a study of this particular legend or that which the rabbis taught about the Bible revealed that they taught it for a deeply moral and religious purpose. And it was added to the legends of the Bible for a particular and quite understandable reason. Let me illustrate with an observation which came to my mind just during the past week. I had occasion last week to see a series of brilliantly done color reproductions of the stained glass windows in the Sainte-Chapelle chancel in Paris. These windows are world famous. They are medieval, and they represent a series of tableaus of familiar biblical scenes. In the first window, we see the magnificent panorama of creation. We see the creation of man and of Eve. We see the scenes of the Garden of Eden, the enticement and the punishment. We see the wiles of the serpent and his punishment. We see Cain and Abel and the fratricide, the murder of Abel by Cain. And in the very next panel, however, we come across a scene which is unfamiliar to most of us. The scene is out in open country. A strong, burly giant sort of a man, rather advanced in age and apparently blind, has hefted a large crossbow to his shoulder. At his side, there stands a younger man who is apparently pointing out to this older man the direction of the target. And somewhat in the distance, behind a little rise of land, we see a man lying shot, an arrow apparently hurled forth from the giant's crossbow, deeply embedded in his forehead. Now, search as you will in the biblical text, you will find no episode which corresponds to this window in the Sainte-Chapelle in Paris. And yet the window is designed to be an interpretation of the Bible and a collection of portraits of biblical episodes. But if you turn to the Midrash Tanhuma, a collection of Midrashim compiled in the 10th century, you'll find in this Midrash an interesting story which is the basis of this window in the Sainte-Chapelle. The story concerns one Lamech. Lamech was the seventh in the line of progenitors of Israel who stand between Adam and Eve and Noah. According to the Bible, we know very little of Lamech. We know simply that his father was Methuselah, that he lived to till he was very full of days, and that he died having two sons who followed after him. We know only one other thing about this Lamech, and that is all that the Bible tells us. And that is that he at one time shouted out to his wives, "If a man wounds me, I will kill him. If a man bruises me, I will slay him." We do not know what caused this uttering of a curse, a particularly ferocious curse. We know simply that it is recorded in our Bible. And that is all that the Bible tells us about Lamech. But in Midrash Tanhuma, we read this. Lamech, as he got on in years, became blind. In his youth, the hunt had been his favorite sport. He could not give up the hunt despite his blindness. And he induced one of his sons, Tubal-Cain, to go along with him always into the field to point out to him the direction of the prey, of the target. And then he would unloose the bolt of his crossbow against the animal whom Tubal-Cain had pointed out. And on a particular day, Tubal-Cain led his father out into the field, and they noticed movement in the thicket out yonder. And Tubal-Cain pointed the crossbow of his father towards this thicket, and his father shot the arrow. And when Tubal-Cain went to retrieve the prey, he found that his father had not shot an animal, but a human being. Indeed, he had shot one of his ancestors, the fratricide Cain. Cain, the murderer of Abel, who according to our Bible had been condemned to perpetual wandering as a nomad, as an exile from all human companionship upon the face of the earth. Now, this is a strange, somewhat bloodthirsty story. We wonder what could possibly be the purpose of its invention. Was it simply that reading the Bible, ancient teacher felt that the punishment of Cain for his heinous crime was not sufficient, and that Cain must not only be condemned to permanent exile, what we would call life imprisonment, but that he must, after a protracted period of life imprisonment, finally be put to death? And yet I wonder, I wonder if the secret of the invention of this biblical legend lies not in the very two lines of ferocious curse which Lamech himself, according to our Bible, is purported to have said. If a man wounds me, I will slay him. If a man but bruises me, I will kill him. This curse takes us back to most ancient times. It takes us back to the age in which the blood feud was still accepted as common practice. If I wounded a man from another tribe, that tribe had the right to exact a wound in retaliation from any member of my tribe. If I killed a man from another tribe, that tribe in retaliation had the right to protect itself from such acts by killing any member of my tribe. And there were individuals in the ancient world who, because of their vocation, smiths and tinkers and wandering merchants and the like, who had to leave the security of the tribal group, and who therefore protected themselves with particularly ferocious forms of blood retaliation. If they were wounded, then they exacted a life. And that is apparently what the curse of Lamech implies. And I wonder if in ancient days some of our ancestors reading this curse were not struck by its archaism and did not come to feel that despite the fact that the Bible in no way establishes this as a principle of law or holds it up as a moral way of life, if they did not want to reinterpret this verse so as to denude it of these bloodthirsty implications. And did they not perhaps create this legend of Lamech, blind Lamech, shooting Cain, in order to be able to grammatically reinterpret Lamech's curse so that it would say, I shot a man for wounding me. I slew a man, and I am sorry for it. And by having established a legend accounting for the possibility of Lamech having slain one of his ancestors, they were able to grammatically force a reinterpretation of the biblical text, which cleansed the biblical text of this dross of an archaic practice, and which made it speak to them in the high moral tones to which they were accustomed. Such is the Midrash. It is a wonderful collection of legend and of lore, of interpretation and of exegesis, which opens to the student and to the reader the fullest implications of the grandeur of our Bible. I commend it to you. Many of the Midrashic collections are now available in competent English translations. The legends with which the Midrashic writers embroidered the biblical text is now available in many a competent, edited, and translated work. It will reward a few hours which you spend in reading this text. You will appreciate the Bible the more. You will come to understand more fully the nature of the Jewish religious genius. And you will come to understand more clearly and to respect more completely the moral fervor and the moral understanding which have been basic components of Jewish life from the earliest days of Abraham and Moses to our own. Amen.